Random House Audiobooks presents Mark Twain by Jeffrey C. Ward, Dayton Duncan, and Ken Burns. Read for you by Bill Misley. Prologue. Late in the afternoon on Thursday, May 29th, 1902, Will Sutton, desk clerk of the Windsor Hotel in Hannibal, Missouri, was lounging behind his counter, just as he did every weekday, when two strangers walked in and asked for rooms. They were just off the 5:35 train from St. Louis. Sutton didn't recognize the first man. He turned out to be a young newspaper reporter named Robertus Love, on assignment for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. But Love's much older companion, small and slender with a drooping mustache, a tangle of light gray hair, and a suit to match, was the most readily recognizable American on earth. His real name was Samuel Langhorne Clemens, but he was better known even here in his old hometown by his pen name, Mark Twain. Sutton stammered with excitement as the old man signed the register. "Mr. Clemens, I was born close to your birthplace, and have been in the house where you were born, often." "I was not born often, only once," Clemens drawled. "But I'm glad to see you all the same." They shook hands, and Sutton handed over a room key. Clemens climbed the stairs, unlocked his door, and closed it behind him. He was 66 years old and weary. He hadn't been back to the town where he'd spent his boyhood in years, and had told no one he was coming. The visit had been an afterthought, an unplanned stop on the long train journey from his current home in Riverdale-on-Hudson, just north of New York City, to Columbia, Missouri, where the state university was to give him an honorary degree. And he knew he would need rest before the excitement that was sure to follow him wherever he went the following morning. He climbed into bed, lit a cigar, and read till he grew sleepy. Hannibal had been home to a little more than 3,000 souls when 17-year-old Sam Clemens had left it to make his fortune in the summer of 1853. Steamboats had provided its only contact with a wider world then. A Hannibal citizen's first visit to the metropolis of St. Louis, population 30,000, just 150 miles downriver, had been enough, Clemens recalled, for him to talk St. Louis and nothing but St. Louis and its wonders for months and months afterwards. Now the village where Clemens had spent his formative years had itself become a small industrial city with more than 12,000 citizens. Steamboats seldom visited its riverfront anymore, but 56 passenger trains stopped there every day. So did 34 freight trains. There were 112 factories in town, including the largest cement plant in the world, and streetcars plied streets where young Sam Clemens had once walked barefoot. He, too, had changed, almost beyond recognition since he'd first left Hannibal, and he had crowded into the intervening 5 decades enough experiences for half a dozen ordinary lifetimes. He'd been a printer and a riverboat pilot before the Civil War, then served briefly as a Confederate militiaman. He'd gone west and tried silver mining, became a hard-drinking newspaper man in Virginia City and a humorous lecturer in San Francisco. He had witnessed firsthand the corruption and greed that gripped Washington, D.C., during the era he was the first to call the Gilded Age, and had himself lived the gaudy life of a would-be millionaire before his own overreaching drove him and his family into bankruptcy and exile overseas. He had redeemed his reputation and rebuilt his fortune through his own hard work, only to suffer the loss of his dearest child. He'd recovered from that as well, and since 1900 had somehow managed to make himself simultaneously an outspoken critic of American adventurism abroad and America's best-loved public figure. But above all, he had been a writer, pouring forth torrents of words, 24 volumes of fiction and essays so far, with still more books in the works, along with plays and occasional poetry, political diatribes, irreverent musings about God and man, and thousands of private letters that revealed his innermost desires and deepest insecurities. But he was still best known for 2 novels of boyhood set in a small Mississippi river town very like Hannibal, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, in which he transformed his own often difficult early years into an idol that became the envy of generations of American boys and girls, and Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which proved for the first time that art could be created out of the American language, while laying bare the contradictions at the heart of American life, slavery and racism. If you attempt to create and build a wholly imaginary incident, adventure, situation, he once wrote in a notebook, you will go astray, and the artificiality of the thing will be detectable. But if you found on a fact in your personal experience, it is an acorn, a root, and every created adornment that grows up out of it and spreads its foliage and blossoms to the sun will seem realities, not inventions. You will not be likely to grow astray. Your compass of fact is there to keep you on the right course. During his long, astonishingly prolific literary career, he had drawn upon facts from every part of his life, but his memories of Hannibal had always remained the true north of his compass of fact, and it was good to be home again. Word spread overnight that Hannibal's favorite son had returned, and a sizable crowd was waiting outside when he and Roberta's love emerged from their hotel at 9:30 a.m. and started off on foot for Clemens' old family home at 206 Hill Street. "The house I lived in when I whitewashed the fence 53 years ago," he called it in a letter to his wife, Livy. "It all seems so small to me," he said when he and the jostling crowd got there. "I suppose if I should come back here 10 years from now, it would be the size of a birdhouse." Mrs. Henry Garth, the well-to-do widow of one of his closest childhood friends, took him out to the Mount Olivet Cemetery in her carriage so that he could visit the graves of those he called my people. His mother Jane, dead 12 years now, his luckless older brother Orion, his younger brother Henry, for whose accidental death 44 years before he still blamed himself, and his father, John Marshall Clemens, whose early death had forced young Sam to go to work while still a schoolboy. That afternoon, an informal reception for Clemens was held at the Farmers and Merchants Bank. Old schoolmates crowded in to shake his hand. "How you doing, Eddie?" he asked one. "Like yourself, Sam," the old man said. "Like a cow's tail going down." Clemens laughed. Gritty turns of phrase like that were his literary stock in trade. He went on to attend a Memorial Day ceremony at his mother's old Presbyterian church and dined that evening at Mrs. Garth's with Laura Hawkins Fraser, his childhood sweetheart, and the model for the golden-curled object of Tom Sawyer's affections, Becky Thatcher, who was now a stout widow with false teeth, in charge of Hannibal's Home for the Friendless. Then he hurried to the Opera House to hand out diplomas at the Hannibal High School commencement. "Take one," he told the students. "Pick out a good one. Don't take two, but be sure you get a good one." "It has been a rushing day," he wrote home to Livy that evening, and the next 3 days were almost as busy. Some members of the throng that continued to follow him around town had now chosen to dress up as characters from his books. "Today Hannibal is full of Huck Finns, Tom Sawyers, and Beckys," Robertus Love reported to his readers. "There are more originals of Huck, Tom, and Becky in this town since Mark Twain arrived than one would expect to meet in a state-old town with 23 respectable Sunday schools and a Salvation Army. You don't need to bait your hook if you go fishing for a Huck. Just make a cast anywhere around town, and there's your huckleberry." On Saturday evening, Clemens agreed to speak before a hastily arranged meeting of the Ladies' Labina Club, Hannibal spelled backward. He was the country's most popular platform performer as well as its best-known writer, and audiences like this one were ordinarily child's play for him. But this crowd was different. Seated among the 500 townspeople who had squeezed into the hall to hear him were 7 of his boyhood friends, white-haired now and bent with age. At first, things went well, and he had everyone laughing at a story from his youth in which his mother played a part. Then suddenly, he bowed his head to hide his tears. "I realize that this must be my last visit to Hannibal," he told his anxious listeners when he could bring himself to speak again. "And in bidding you hail, I also bid you farewell." Robertus Love wrote. His voice was choked, his utterance was broken. It was the
sample complete. Ready to continue?